You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Arianna Huffington knows a thing or two about success. Having launched Huffington Post in 2005, it's grown to have over 84 million unique visitors last October and international editions in 10 countries with more scheduled to launch later this year. But in 2007, Arianna Huffington passed out due to exhaustion and lack of sleep, and that led her to reevaluate her life. Over the last 7 years, she's come to redefine what success means and how to achieve it, and she shares what she's learned in her latest book, Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom, and wonder. It's published by Harmony, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her back to our show.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
You begin with the story of how you passed out. You fell, broke your cheekbone in 2007, woke up in a pool of your own blood. Had you realized how exhausted you'd become?
No, and that is really what is so stunning, that it's not just that I collapsed, but that I didn't even know that I was tired. And that's what I'm finding as I go around speaking about the book, how many people are in similar positions. There was a woman who came up to me in San Francisco and she said, I don't remember the last time I was not tired. So we begin to feel, because of this collective delusion we're under, that burnout is the way to success, that that's normal.
Well, we live on adrenaline, many of us. I know I do. Huffington Post was still relatively new at that time. Was getting the site up and running one of the reasons that you had pushed your body to that point?
I think it was a combination of things. One was this delusion that if you're going to have something successful, a startup, a project, a life, you have to just work around the clock, which I'm now convinced, and the science is pretty conclusive, is not the case. That in fact, when we take care of ourselves, we sleep enough, meditate, move, whatever it is that recharges us, we are going to be more effective at everything we're doing. These are truly performance enhancement tools.
But is it different psychologically from the people whose well-being is put aside because they are working at low-paying jobs, physically demanding jobs just to survive?
I think it is the messages and the practices that I recommend in Thrive are applicable whatever you're doing, whether you're at the top of the heap or whether you're struggling to put food on the table, because all the practices are really about recognizing that we have inner strength, inner wisdom, inner peace inside us, and we need to just give ourselves a little time to connect with those. And if we're struggling, if we're facing very challenging circumstances, we're going to be more resilient if we're connected with our own strength.
Well, do we ignore it because it doesn't seem important at the time, or because it's one of those things we always say we'll get around to?
I think it's the latter, and I think it's the fact that our culture has been driven by this assumption that the two metrics that define success are just money and power, and therefore sacrificing everything to those is worthwhile. And that's why I write in the book about the need for a third metric that includes our well-being as well as our wisdom and wonder and giving. And then that's a truly complete life.
But there are some people who don't seem to have the problem. Are there some who just figure this out naturally, or perhaps just have different body chemistry that allows them to work all those hours and on very little sleep? Edison, for example, said he had 4 hours sleep a night.
Yeah, when you actually look through people's biographies, you see that people always overestimate how well they do with little sleep. I mean, there are a few exceptions, of course, but the majority of people need 7 to 8 hours sleep to be fully functioning. And now we have every major university has a sleep division at their medical school that traces the connection between sleep deprivation and disease, obesity, as well as mental clarity and even Alzheimer's disease.
Well, WMIC has launched a sleep project, and listeners, in fact, can still sign up to track their sleep by going to WNYC.org/sleep. Next week, we'll be breaking into teams for a 2-week challenge to get an extra hour of sleep. Can technology help us figure out how to improve our sleep?
First of all, I'm delighted that you are doing this because now, I mean, the science is so incontrovertible. When we launched our sleep section in 2007, there was a lot of skepticism. But now this is the global shift that's happening that has allowed people to recognize the importance of sleep and recharging. In terms of whether technology can help us, I know it's a paradox, but it can. But we first need to acknowledge that we need to learn to disconnect from technology and reconnect with ourselves. And that includes not charging our smartphones by our bed. This is one of my recommendations, because often what happens is that you wake up in the middle of the night for whatever reason, you're going to be tempted to look at your data.
You also have to turn off that little sound thing on the smartphone, because if you wake up in the middle of the night, you hear emails coming in, usually junk emails, but it reminds you that that phone is still working.
Exactly. And really, we have become addicted to our devices, and I don't use the word lightly. And that's why I actually have 12 steps I'm proposing in the book to cure us of this addiction.
Well, you'd been exposed to some of the practices that you took up before your fall, like yoga and meditation. Had they fallen by the wayside as you got busier?
Yes, exactly. So, yes, I was very blessed to have a mother to whom the book is dedicated, who, even when we lived in a one-room apartment in Athens with no money, made us feel that we were bigger than our circumstances and that we had infinite possibilities in us. And she taught us to meditate when I was 13, to do yoga. But exactly what you said, then they did fall by the wayside. And now they've been incorporated in my life as daily practices, and the results are tangible and amazing.
Well, why do you say that women pay a higher price than men?
Well, the data show that women in stressful jobs, because of the way we internalize stress more, women in stressful jobs have a 40% greater risk of heart disease and a 60% greater risk of diabetes.
Oh, we always thought that men were more likely to have heart disease.
Well, because men were more likely to be at the top in more stressful jobs. But now that that's changing, although we still have a way to go, and women have more and more responsibilities, more demands on their time, we see the impact that has.
And yet I keep on hearing about more and more men complaining about higher levels of burnout and being overwhelmed. Is it because we're more aware of it?
Oh, no, I think women are very aware of it, too. I mean, you see women leaving the workplace, you know, especially after they have children. 43% of women leave the workplace after they have children, and only 40% of those who return full-time.
And I've just heard about the glass cliff. Do you know about that? Women CEOs are less likely to stay on the job for a long time than male CEOs.
That's why in the book I call for a third women's revolution. You know, the first one gave us the vote. The second gave us access to all jobs and the top of every field. But the third is required if we're going to really change the workplace. So it's not driven by the kind of burnout and fueled by sleep deprivation and exhaustion, which makes so many women leave.
My guest is Arianna Huffington. Her latest book, Thrive, The Third Metric to Redefining Success and Creating a Life of Well-Being, Wisdom, and Wonder. One of the tools that you talk about a lot in the book is mindfulness meditation. How is that different than just meditation?
No, mindfulness is just something that we can bring into practice whether we're meditating or not. It really means basically being fully present in what we're doing, which is the opposite of what we tend to do, which is multitasking. You know, we're here in New York, you walk down the street and you see so many people who are either on their phones or even worse, texting while walking.
Or driving.
Or driving, which has led to many deaths and tens of thousands of accidents. So I think that is really the problem. It's like, how can we come fully present and not miss the moment? My mother used to say, don't miss the moment.
So you don't have to meditate to find the state of mindfulness.
I think that it's everybody has to decide what is it that can lead them to that state of mindfulness, which incidentally includes heartfulness, because the Chinese word for mind is also heart. So we mean heartfulness as well. And, you know, for people, for some people, it can be prayer. It can be contemplation. If you're a Quaker, it can be what they call quiet time. The point is just some time with no distractions and no devices.
Well, people are already complaining about being overextended, and now you're telling them they have to find more time to quiet down.
Well, I'm so glad, actually, you asked that, because everything I'm saying is not another thing to add to our to-do list. It's something that transforms everything else we do. Like when we invest that time in ourselves, everything else we're going to do is truly transformed. I mean, I find, for example, that the way we tend to lead our lives, always feeling that we are running out of time, breathlessly, always feeling it's later than we thought, is just completely unnecessary. And all these practices, meditation, movement, sleep, can help us avoid what is known as time famine.
Well, every week it seems there's a new study that extols the health benefits of meditation, including reducing anxiety, helping with depression, boosting the immune system, fighting everything from arthritis to diabetes. On the other hand, I know people who have tried meditation only to discover that it's not always so easy.
Well, only if we expect it to silence our mind. I think there are a lot of false expectations around meditation. And when we realize that when we meditate, it doesn't mean that thoughts don't come in. It just means that we can get better and better at not clinging to these thoughts and returning to the breath or the mantra, whatever form of meditation we are doing. And that's really the process. I think there are now a lot of apps. You asked about technology helping. I have a whole appendix in the book of different apps that we can use to help us meditate. And I think experimenting with different ones to see what can connect us with ourselves most easily.
So we can leave our cell phone next to the bed as long as the app is helping us meditate.
Well, I personally actually advocate not leaving the cell phone by our bed, because I think we are weak creatures and we are going to be very likely to check our data. So I think we can do a look at our app for meditation, not while we're going to sleep.
As you started to integrate these practices into your life, did they lead to changes at the Huffington Post?
Yes. Well, first of all, editorially, ever since 2007, when after my collapse and my wake-up call, we started integrating a lot of writing and inviting our readers to give us their experiences on all these topics with dedicated sections. We now have 26 sections on these topics, ranging from sleep to meditation to co-parenting, you know, because a lot of these issues have to do also with anxiety around the problems in our lives. And we have found an incredible response from our readers.
But a media organization like Huffington Post, with its time-pressured deadlines, seems diametrically opposed to a lot of the values that you describe here. Can mindfulness and napping coexist with deadlines and social media strategies?
Well, we are demonstrating that they can. In fact, 3 years ago, we instituted 2 nap rooms. And at first, there were a lot of rolled eyes. But in fact, we now see that people are using them all the time, and we have to start a third one. We have regular meditation, yoga, and breathing classes. We have an email policy whereby our editors and reporters are not expected to answer emails after hours or over the weekend, unless they are in the overnight or the weekend shift. So absolutely, it's very compatible.
Gee, I was answering emails while I was on vacation in Italy.
Oh,
recently.
Not good, not good. Did you know that?
Well, because Italy helped out, because the Wi-Fi wasn't always so dependable.
Good. So you got some time away from your emails.
Whether I wanted to or not. Arianna Huffington is the co-founder, president, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group. Her latest book, Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom, and wonder, is published by Harmony Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Arianna Huffington. her latest book. How many books have you written, Ariana?
14.
Starting off with writing about art. The first time we talked was Picasso
in 88. So it's almost 25 years ago. My daughter is 25 today, and she was born in 89. So, yes, but I love that because I find that with every book I write, I learn. And I, you know, they say you write about what you need to teach yourself. And writing Thrive has allowed me to be talking about things that reinforce these messages for myself.
And the book is called Thrive, the third metric to redefining success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom, and wonder. It's published by Harmony Books. You write about other companies that are encouraging their employees to take up mindfulness, meditation, and other centering practices. Why are CEOs finding that is a good business practice?
What is great now is that we are collecting a lot of data that it is a good business practice. Let me give you one example. Mark Bertolini, the CEO of Aetna, the third largest health insurance company in America, had a skiing accident, broke his neck, and spent a year hooked on narcotics, very, very difficult to function. And then he discovered meditation, yoga, acupuncture, then it had an incredible impact on him. So he made them available to all his 49,000 employees and then brought Duke University to study the result, and they found a 7% reduction in healthcare costs and a 69-minute-a-day improvement in productivity.
But isn't there a big gap between the companies that would do that sort of thing and the companies who fight raising the minimum wage and actually monitor the people who work for them?
Absolutely. In fact, what we're seeing
now... Do you think
now,
those people are being counterproductive?
They are, and I think also we are... Because we are now in this amazing time of transition and a true global shift, I think it's equivalent to moving from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. And I think if you are living during that time, you would be able to notice both realities coexisting for a while. So we now have 35% of American companies that are introducing stress reduction practices and do care for their health and well-being of their employees. And then we have the rest of them, still the majority, that think that what matters is for employees to be at their desks from 7 to 10 and in fact miss the point that increasingly as more and more functions of our jobs are being taken over by algorithms and technology, what is valued more than anything is creativity and good ideas, and this is precisely what falls by the wayside when you are stressed and burnt out.
But do you think some of the resistance has to do with the way some people associate what you're talking about with new agey concepts?
Well, yes, absolutely. But it's hard to continue to associate them with new age concepts when there's such incontrovertible science from Harvard and Stanford. And
meditation
Duke.
Has been shown to be good for us.
Yeah, I think the people who still associate them with flaky new age concepts are the same people probably who still think that global warming is a fantasy. You know, there are some people who are never going to be persuaded by data. But I think the rest have recognized the importance, whether they have applied it in their lives or not.
Why do you think there's still so much resistance to things, in fact, to anything scientists say, like climate change, like evolution? The majority of Americans do not believe in evolution.
I think that sometimes people have a hard time changing beliefs. I mean, remember...
We're moving in the other direction. More people believed in evolution 20 years ago than they do now.
Well, it's a little bit like when Copernicus looked through his telescope and discovered the Earth was flat. A lot of people remained believers in the flat Earth concept long after we knew it was not the case.
The paradox that one of the selling points of mindfulness is improved performance is that it improves performance. So can unplugging and meditating ultimately help you get ahead?
Well, that is a paradox. And what I say in the book is that it doesn't really matter what your entry point is. what matters is to start on this journey. If your entry point is that you want to be successful and use these tools as performance enhancement tools, go ahead. In the process, you will discover that you are more than your job.
Well, you're right that we have more and more information today and less wisdom. Is that one of the reasons that a lot of people don't believe in climate change, or are you talking about something else there?
No, that's definitely part of it. I think that we have a lot more data, and we have kind of worshipped big data. But the truth is that big data do not necessarily lead to wisdom. Indeed, very often it may mean that the needle is coming in an increasingly larger haystack, and connecting with our own wisdom in order to find it is key.
Well, there was a time when you could truly be a Renaissance man because all of the knowledge of the world was within the grasp of one person. Today, that's impossible.
But I love this poem by T.S. Eliot. Actually, I'll read you a couple of lines. He wrote, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" And I think that kind of sums up a lot of our modern times.
My guest is Arianna Huffington. Her latest book, Thrive, the third metric to rebuilding success and creating a life of well-being, wisdom, and wonder. It's published by Harmony Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Getting back to sleep, we have talked about sleep a lot on this show as well. And it's easy enough to say to somebody, you need to get more sleep. But then they wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and can't go back to sleep.
Yes, and that's why I have a lot of specific steps in the book of what people can do. And it starts with disengaging from their work and their devices before they go to sleep, which means often people, you know, literally take their smartphones to bed and they answer emails like until they turn off the lights. And that clearly makes no sense because you need a transition time. And you need to find your own rituals to get there. I mean, my ritual is having a hot bath and letting the day go, moving my device outside my bedroom. In fact, my bedroom is a completely device-free zone.
You don't have a television set there?
I have a television that I occasionally turn on over the weekend, but I don't have. I don't take my Kindle, my iPhones, or my Blackberries to bed. I just read real books.
Well, the reason I mentioned television, a lot of people fall asleep while watching television. And then they turn off the television and they can't go to sleep.
Well, that's because they are used to it. But I think sleeping with the television on...
Well, maybe the TV is more boring than real life.
But definitely sleeping with the television on and then waking up because there is something noisier being said is not the best way to recharge.
Well, much of what you've been talking about seems like common sense. Get more sleep, look at our smart devices less, connect with our friends and family more. But it's kind of hard to actually do these things, or it's hard for a lot of people.
That's why I have baby steps. I mean, really, I think the book is divided into three parts mixed together. The first is my own personal journey so that people can have a sense of one woman's journey. The second is the incredible scientific findings that validate ancient wisdom. And I have 55 pages of scientific endnotes that can convince the most stubborn skeptic. And the third one is an enormous amount of poetry and literature and ancient philosophy to show, as you said earlier, Leonard, that we kind of know all these things with some part of our brain or our soul, but we've forgotten them. And, I mean, we know that Socrates said, know thyself, or that death is part of life, even though we try to ignore it and pretend it's not. I mean, I have an Onion headline here that said death rate holds steady at 100%. And, you know, the Romans used to scratch MM on trees and memento mori on trees and statues, not out of morbidity, but to kind of put our problems in perspective and prioritize what matters. But somehow our modern culture has pushed all this knowledge and wisdom aside and glorified just go-getting. And that's why the last section of the book is about giving. Because, again, our genes are wired for giving, but so often we forget to actually reconnect with that part of ourselves.
Well, recently we've been reading in the Huffington Post and elsewhere about some very wealthy people who feel that they've been getting a bad rap because they don't want to pay more taxes. They don't want to give. They're being called greedy. And they said, well, you know, I earned this by my hard labor or the fact that my father left me a lot of money. But they don't seem to be all that unhappy about the fact that they're not giving.
Well, we don't know how unhappy they are. I mean, I think as Nora Ephron said, nobody knows about anybody else's marriage, including your own. And I think that's even more true about happiness and unhappiness. But we do know, just by looking at the data, that a lot of very successful people become addicts, depressed, and deal with a lot of problems, emotional and psychological, that are preventable when people recognize the importance of giving. And in fact, we know giving is a shortcut to happiness. The science, again, is incontrovertible.
There's a great term that you use in the book when you're writing about multitasking, continuous partial attention.
Yes, because, you know, we think that multitasking is efficient, that it saves us time. And in fact, the science shows that there is no such thing as multitasking. It's actually task switching, and it's one of the most stressful things we can do. And continuous partial attention is one of the kind of defining characteristics of our time. And yet we all know that whenever we're in love or we are truly immersed in a project, it requires 100% of our attention. And that's when we are most creative. That's when we are most connected to our own wisdom and joy. So this thing may, as you said, this may seem like big changes, but in fact, these 12 steps that I'm proposing are very small, like they're getting 30 minutes more sleep a night, starting with 5 minutes of meditation. At the end of each day, dropping something we no longer need. It could be a resentment. It could be a negative self-talk. It could be a project we're not going to engage in. All these things are very practical, very doable, and transformational.
When we get distracted, how long does it take us to recover and refocus?
Well, actually,
because we're getting distracted all the time.
All the time. And in fact, we don't automatically refocus. But as long as we can connect with our breath, for me, that's my thread in and out of the minotaur of our bad habits is whenever I get stressed or rushed, reconnect with my breath. And
you listen to your own breath?
I kind of consciously inhale and exhale deeply for like 10 seconds, and it has a real impact.
Why is wonder an important component of the third metric? Is wonder a form of mindfulness in that you have to be aware to wonder at something?
Yes. I mean, when you are distracted, you kind of miss a lot of the wonder and mystery of life. And whether you're a believer or an atheist, it's sort of wonderful to be able to be connected with the mystery of life. And I was recently speaking to the founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, and he said to me, I consider myself a mystical atheist. So whatever you consider yourself, life is amazingly mysterious, and wonder at life helps us connect with that mystery.
Although it is interesting that many of the things that you are outlining here are also parts of pretty much every major religion.
Absolutely.
And yet we don't necessarily see them in people who practice those religions.
Well, you know, because there's a difference between religion practiced simply in terms of dogma and religion and spiritual practices that are really recognizing and acknowledging that at the heart of every religion is really loving and connecting with our fellow human beings as we connect with ourselves.
Although you've been talking about these topics more and more in recent years, many people think of you mostly as the founder of the Huffington Post and a political commentator. Were you at all hesitant to reveal this side of yourself?
Oh, not at all. In fact, I think there is a real connection between the themes of Thrive and our political dysfunction at the moment. Because if you look at why say we can't have any sane gun laws in this country, it's partly because so many of our senators and members of Congress have so identified with just their jobs. They really think they are their jobs, that they will not cast a single vote that will threaten their re-election, because that's who they think they are, a senator, a member of Congress. If they actually began to practice the third metric, they realize that they are not just their job, and they might make much braver decisions in the public interest.
Although it can work the other way, as we saw in Colorado, where a number of people in the state legislature voted for more gun control laws, and they were recalled, and they're no longer in the state legislature, replaced by people who are against gun controls.
Right, because we need a critical mass of people who are going to make brave decisions.
Now, you also talk about making sure that you move, whether it's yoga, running, or walking. We did a show recently about sitting and how sitting actually shortens one's life. The recommendation of one of the doctors was don't take that seat on the subway.
Yes.
Insist on being able to stand.
I know. It is amazing. The difference that standing or moving makes in our health. In fact, at the Huffington Post, we get constant requests for standing desks, and we always grant them.
Do you think that we've gotten to an extreme situation in our culture when it comes to busyness and burnout? Is the pendulum starting to swing the other way?
Yes, the pendulum is starting to swing because we've paid such a heavy price. Because we believed in this collective delusion that burnout is the fuel of our success. And a lot of people are just tired and sick of living in the shallows and want to go deeper and bring a bigger perspective and meaning and purpose to our lives.
Arianna Huffington's latest book is Thrive, the Third Metric to Redefining Success and Creating a Life of Well-Being, Wisdom, and Wonder. It's published by Harmony Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you. Great to be with you again.